This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every single week, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, is that a Shakespeare book you're reading right there?
To be or not to be, that is the question. Sorry, Chris. I'm just flipping through a little Shakespeare. You know, I realized how much Shakespeare's actually in Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek VI. I mean, we've got
Star Trek's
Julius Caesar, all sorts of things. In fact, the episode title we're going to be talking about today comes straight from Julius Caesar.
That's right.
The Dogs of War.
Which was also brilliantly quoted by Chang in The Undiscovered Country, your favorite Star Trek film.
Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war.
As we were saying before the show, Matthew, on the other side of the orb, it's a good thing Shakespeare was not a cat.
Oh gosh, can you imagine? Let slip the cats of war? I mean, who says that? It's cats.
I would not feel confident. You know, they would probably like wander over into a sunny spot, lie down, start licking their paws or something while the battle raged around
it
them.
It just doesn't seem to fit. You know, now I think, you know, if we're talking about giant jungle cats like tigers or something, that's different. But
that's
different. When you say cats, that's I just kind of think like house cats that like to chase mice and. Yeah, you know, just look at you when you're like asking them to do something like, are you retarded? I'm a cat.
Exactly. That's the look. That's the look. All right. Well, we're going to be continuing our look at the final chapter today with part 8 of 9, The Dogs of War. We've got a lot of stuff to cover today, Matthew, so let's just jump right on in here. And we're going to go, it's not exactly sequentially through the main points of the episode that we want to talk about, but pretty much right off the bat, we get a replacement for the Defiant with the Sao Paulo. And this is, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit controversial amongst the fan base. The idea that if you destroy a ship and then you bring it right back, it kind of diminishes the impact of that, maybe. Although there were some specific reasons here. Before we talk about those, how did you feel when they bring back another Defiant class ship?
You know, Chris, I thought obviously the fact that Deep Space Nine does need a ship, I mean, the reason for them getting to Defiant was because of the Dominion incursion. They obviously Sisko had been involved in developing the Defiant, and therefore that was the ship that Starfleet gave him because he's very familiar with the specifications of it.
I thought it was just because the ship was badass, just like Sisko.
Yeah, they even had a goatee painted on that, you know, protruding underside for a while, and then they got rid of it. That would have been awesome.
It was a nice touch.
You know how airmen used to paint, you know, women or something like that on the side of their planes. Right, right. I don't know why we couldn't do it with Starfleet ships.
I like a goatee right there on the bottom side of the nose.
So cool.
Of Defiant.
But yeah, okay, so it made sense to me that Deep Space Nine would be getting a replacement for the Defiant. Now, I think everybody is surprised, obviously, that it's another Defiant-class ship. You know, Ezri, I think, speaks for all the fans when she says, I didn't know we were going to be getting another Defiant-class vessel. And I thought it was great, you know, in the sense that when they get a new ship and it is a Defiant-class vessel, before we even know they're going to change the name, that this ship has become synonymous with Deep Space Nine in the same way that...
Well, it's a character.
Exactly. It, you know, in the same way the Enterprise-D was with TNG, or you think of the Constitution class with the original Enterprise. So, you know, you feel connected to that ship, and it just fits with Deep Space Nine. Plus, it docks perfectly with the docking station there between the two pylons. So, I mean, you couldn't really give it any other ship, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you've got universal docking pylons. You know, they could probably dock with a Zindi vessel if they time travel to the, you know.
Chris, how did you feel when you saw them that, you know, I'm trying to put myself back, you know, when I was watching this, it's 1999. Yeah. I'm still very much, I just got out of high school. I'm in college. And to me, it was just badass awesome that they gave him another Defiant. That's how I felt at that point.
I think I'm the same. Like, if I think about it now in terms of overall storytelling, I do understand the point that some people make that if you destroy the ship in The Changing Face of Evil, and then a few episodes later you come back and now there's another Defiant, it sort of weakens the impact of them losing the ship. But at the time that it came on, I remember being shocked that the Defiant had been destroyed because you had a feeling like this ship is invincible. And when they got another ship, I believe my reaction was, oh, that's cool. You know, they deserve to have the ship. And then when they renamed it the Defiant, that also seemed like a great way to honor Sisko and his crew and everything that they had done in the war effort. So I remember liking it, even though maybe it's a little bit odd. But from a storytelling standpoint, Ira said that they decided, and this is interesting, his choice of words. Ira said in the companion that we wanted to kill the Defiant as a statement on how tough the Breen were. He didn't say we wanted to destroy the Defiant like you would normally say about a ship. We wanted to kill the Defiant like you would kill a character. So just as we were saying, it's a character on the show. That makes sense. He said, we thought that would rock the characters and the audience, and I think it did. I think it was very effective in that sense. But then he points out that the reason that they brought the ship back and they brought the Saw Apollo over and renamed it Defiant is that it just made no sense. He said it would actually be preposterous to have the final battle of the war without the Defiant being there.
Yeah, I think, too, at this point, we really don't have any other ships, I think, that are similar enough. I mean, you give it a Steamrunner class or a Norway class or something like that, it's not the same effect, you know, the Defiant.
Let me ask you this, because we saw the Valiant. We actually talked about that here on the show a few shows back. That was a Defiant class ship. Of course we had the Defiant. Now here's the Sao Paulo, redubbed the Defiant. These are all Defiant-class ships. Remember, the original premise of the Defiant was that it was a prototype ship that they were building to fight the Borg, and then they mothballed it because the design wasn't really working out. But as we go through the series and we see these different battles, we start to see Defiant-class ships showing up in these big battle fleets. Did that ever bother you?
You know, it didn't bother me, mainly because, you know, once Deep Space Nine gets the Defiant and is able to figure out the technical aspects of it, you know, the Chief is able to help figure that out with Sisko's help, you know, making it work, Starfleet realizes, okay, we do kind of have a gold mine here. This is a great battleship. It's small, maneuverable, it packs a punch. And this is the kind of ship that we do need fighting somebody like the Borg or now the Dominion.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it never bothered me, but I did find it a little bit odd that suddenly these ships start showing up in these fleets when supposedly there weren't any. And you have to think that it takes serious time to build a starship, even a small one like this. And so they were, I guess, devoting a lot of resources to building these ships.
And that is the one thing. I mean, the Defiant, I think, carries a crew of 48, and it only has four decks. It is a, it is quite a small starship. I mean, it, on a whole, you know, it's like, what, maybe an eighth of the size, you know, or a tenth of the size of, say, like the Enterprise E. So, you know, I think that this is probably a starship that they could build more quickly. And therefore, you know, especially as, you know, by season 3 and 4 of Deep Space 9 and 5, you know, those years there, you've got to think that they're thinking, okay, we probably need some more of these ships with the problems that we're starting to have with people like the Dominion.
Yeah. I'm just picturing when you have most of the Starfleet ships have the nacelles protruding out. And if you think to the JJ, the teaser for the 2009 film where we saw them welding the Enterprise, sparks are flying everywhere. I'm picturing an Apple commercial narrated by Johnny Ive, Admiral Johnny Ive of Starfleet, where they talk about how the Defiant class is molded with a seamless design. It's molded from one piece of titanium.
Yes. Yes. You know, now, Chris,
they're rotating around the ship with a white background.
I love it. Now, on the question of whether it cheapens, I think, the loss of the Defiant and the changing face of evil, the point of losing the ship wasn't that we wanted to destroy the ship, per se. The point was, we need to show exactly how strong this Breen weapon is. What's the toughest ship that we know in Starfleet at this point? It's the Defiant. So if we can destroy the Defiant, everybody, the audience, and the characters are going to be scared of the Breen.
Right. It's the starship equivalent of an alien beaming onto the Enterprise D and kicking Worf's ass.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. So, you know, I think that it really works, and it gives them some great material too. I love Bashir going, "I hate the carpet. I really do."
Right.
Which reminds me of the great line when certain doctors will show up in another doctor's TARDIS and they'll be like, "You redecorated. I don't like it." You know, so I think it really does work, and oh gosh, the scene where Ezri says, "I'll give you guys a few minutes." And the look on Sisko's face is like that guy who just got the brand new car that he wanted so badly. You know, he just doesn't know what to do with himself. So it's fun.
And he says, "Hello, ship."
Yeah, it's great. And that's something we need to mention here. Throughout the whole episode, Avery Brooks directs this episode, but he is spot on. I mean, he just is on this entire episode. I think every scene that he's in, I think he just does an incredible job. I just noticed that rewatching the episode. So I just wanted to mention that, because I think just a small line like that, he just completely sells it. And he is Benjamin Sisko by this point. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Well, he'd better be Benjamin Sisko by this point, Matthew. There's only one episode left in the series.
This is true. But I mean, when I say that, I mean, he's not even trying anymore. It just is him, you know?
Yeah, and it is him.
I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's move on from the ship here and talk about the next topic. And this happens early on as well, when Odo feels betrayed. And the way that he reacts to the news that Bashir gives him, that not only was he the one who infected the Founders, but that he was deliberately infected by Section 31. And there's a sudden and completely understandable change in his mood and his view of the Federation, that I wonder if the series had gone longer, how it would have played out if Odo had to continue working together with Starfleet, knowing what they did to him.
This, I think, really too, gosh, it sets up the fact that Odo's not going to stay in the Alpha Quadrant. I think if this hadn't happened, if he hadn't been infected by Starfleet, but, you know, he'd been infected because he had been with the female changeling, I think he may have actually stayed in the Alpha Quadrant with Kira, but I think this has a huge impact on him finally leaving, because he does feel completely betrayed, even though he knows it's not somebody like Sisko or, you know, yeah, Bashir. But the fact that Starfleet will just sit back and reap the benefits of the evil actions and have no qualms about not giving the, you know, cure to the founders, I think I don't know. It's such a gray area, obviously, and that's why we're having, I mean, it's why it's here in Deep Space Nine. But it really does tarnish Starfleet's reputation.
Definitely. What do you think it says about his character growth through the series? Because I'm just thinking back, when you were saying that, my thought was that Odo upholds justice, and here he sees an organization using this type of tactic, a dishonest tactic. But then I thought back to the fact that, you know, when he was there on Terok Nor with the Cardassians, he was supporting what they were doing, even though they were enslaving the Bajorans. So what do you think it says about his character growth from the time even before the series started, when he was working with the Cardassians, to now? He's taking a different view. It's like it's not such a black and white justice anymore for him.
You know, I was going to say is I feel like that he has a much more human sense of justice.
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, and I think that that's a really interesting thing to see Odo have and kind of grow into. He doesn't see any kind of justice really in the Cardassian system. But I think from knowing these people, the Bajorans, I think the humans, Starfleet, the Federation, he's seen a sense of justice, a sense of right and wrong, which he does feel has kind of an overarching, like everybody could get behind really the basic moral beliefs of the Federation. And yet here he's seeing them not live up to those beliefs. And I think it does do something to him. I think it breaks maybe a little something in him seeing that. And I do think it has a big implication on him going back to the Gamma Quadrant instead of staying in the Alpha Quadrant with Kira. It kind of drives him back to his people, which in the end, honestly, it's just a kind of a cool story element. The fact that they're just kind of weaving it all together, and I think it works really well to get where we get to at the end. But the fact that Starfleet would just sit back and do this, it bothers me in the episode. And I like how Odo's having to have the conversation with Benjamin, and Benjamin, you can tell he is completely uncomfortable with the fact that Starfleet isn't going to do anything. Like, he's uncomfortable.
Right, because Odo asks him, what is Starfleet going to do about it? I think it's important to note that Starfleet didn't infect Odo. Section 31 infected, right, Odo, and Sisko tells him, look, Section 31's not part of the Federation, which actually it is part of the Federation.
Yeah, it's part of the original charter.
I think what Sisko is trying to say is that they don't represent us. They are a rogue organization. They're not part of the governmental structure, the decision-making of the Federation. Federation Starfleet didn't do this to you. Section 31 did. What did you think about Odo telling him that isn't that convenient? That you can say they're not part of you, but when they do something that could help you in the war effort, you just turn a blind eye, because Sisko tells him that we couldn't, you know, the council considered giving the cure to the founders and they voted against it. So you can say Section 31 is not part of the Federation and we're not behind this, but when they had a chance to actually set it right, they didn't take it.
I think that's the most damning thing towards the Federation and really all of Deep Space Nine are these actions here. And what it does, I think, is show very legitimately what happens when the fear of something like the Dominion comes upon us. And obviously, Deep Space Nine is before 9/11 happening.
Yeah.
But they're already talking about these issues. about how fear makes us do things that we might not necessarily do. And what exactly is the line when it comes to war? Is a conversation that we'll be having forever, I think, as human beings.
Because even though this is pre-9/11 and a lot of the things that we see happening on DS9 are very applicable to the world post-9/11, and of course, even what we see going on today, and some of the legislation even passed or considered around the world this week as we're recording this as a result of the threat from Islamic State. But it's not like this never happened before. You can look back through history at wars and see how these types of actions were taken against groups of people or different organizations in the past. So it is something that will always be with us. But I think today when you look back at it, DS9, it almost seems prophetic in the way that we interpret what we're seeing on the show, because it applies so much to something that we're right in the middle of right now.
And it's the thing that makes Deep Space Nine stand apart, because it's willing to, I think, have an honest conversation about these issues. I think it is, there was an article that it talked about Deep Space Nine is the most realistic of the Star Treks, because it's realistically depicting galactic politics, galactic war, galactic clashes of ideals. You know, this is more of what it's like really to live in a galaxy full of people who don't all agree.
Yeah, assuming that we could all actually be close enough together or travel fast enough.
Exactly. But I mean, it's a great look at our own world, and that's what Star Trek always did the best. When it was at its best, was kind of helping us shine a light on ourselves, and kind of that meta sense, like rise above, you know, the particulars to get to something bigger and grander. Yeah. And they're telling a really big story here.
Well, we've talked about that here in the final chapter discussion before. We actually named one of the episodes, I don't remember if it was the last one or the one before that, but we named it The Maiden Narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
definitely.
We were talking about that exact thing.
I don't know, Chris, kind of thinking through this idea with Odo, how do you feel about the whole way that Starfleet handles this issue after, you know, they find out what Section 31's done?
Well, I mean, in a perfect world, they would have given the cure to the founders, but I think Sisko's right. They couldn't do that. That would strengthen the enemy, and you can't do that in that situation. And it's hard, because you never want to look at another group of people as being, what is the word? Like, you don't want to dehumanize another group of people. At the same time, what we're dealing with here in Deep Space Nine is the fact that this group of aliens from the other side of the galaxy, their goal is to exterminate all of you or enslave all of you in the Federation. So then you're left with the decision of, you know, do you treat them equally and respectfully and try to find a peaceful solution, even though it's clear that one will never be achieved? Or do you take care of your own and do what you need to do to preserve your civilization? And it's one of those conversations that, if you want to get academic about it and theoretical about it, we can talk all day about what the proper course of action would be. But in real life, in the reality of the moment, you're forced to make decisions like the Federation Council made here. That Section 31 infected Odo. They tried to carry out genocide against the enemy, which is, of course, wrong. We have a cure now, but if we give it to the enemy, they are going to be back up to full strength. And they clearly aren't going to say, thank you so much for saving us. Let's, you know, go have some coffee now. Everything's cool. They're going to come after you anyway.
Well, and I do think that it plays out in the last episode, the fact that the Dominion is crushed, and you know, the only reason that the female changeling, you know, says stop is because Odo decides to come home. It has nothing to do with the fact that they've got a cure or anything. It's just that they're one, and I mean that they're one. Odo has decided he will come home, and for that is enough for her to tell the rest of the forces to stand down. But I mean, in the end, their forces were completely obliterated.
Yeah. Well, they were going to fight to the end. In this episode we're talking about today, the Dogs of War, Wayun even says that the Dominion has never surrendered in the 10,000 years since its founding. You know, they are going to fight to the bitter end. So I think that's something that the Federation understands. And so they're not going to hand the enemy an advantage.
Well, and that's something that I guess we'll talk about in a little bit. Just the fact that where the allies come to in this episode. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really interesting conversation.
So let's go on to the next thing here. This discussion's a bit more segmented than some of the ones that we've had, because this episode itself is basically a bridge from everything that's come before to what's going to happen in the final episode. So you get a lot of sort of spot treatments of different characters in different situations. So one that we've talked about a lot, especially early on in the final chapter, was the relationship between Bashir and Ezri. And they've gotten to the point where they just avoid each other. They just, if they see the other person somewhere, they'll turn around, they'll go the other way because they can't come face to face. Finally here, they decide to talk to each other, and they're a lot like school kids, don't you think, Matthew?
You know, it is. They have that classic conversation of the DTR. We got to define the relationship, and do we want to ruin the friendship? And they're both kind of scared. And I really do like the conversation that they end up having. You know, Bashir talks about how, you know, usually if I like somebody, I just go for it. And I think one of the signs of this, that it was something completely different, that it was more real, was the fact that they were both avoiding it. They were really scared. And, you know, I think the thing that really sold this whole thing for me is there's some serious chemistry between these two on screen. Just the mm-hmm. looks that they have towards each other, the way they're acting towards each other, the whole scene where he runs into her on accident in the... Replimat.
He was married to Nana at this time, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I felt like it worked really well. I enjoy the resolution to their story. To me, it was kind of a poetic justice to have Bashir end up with a Dax in the end.
Yeah, and that's true. That's a good point.
It rounded out the series very well. I thought it was fun and unexpected, because, of course, you know, Bashir had always been in love with... Jenzia, but what I loved about this is that he spends the time to get to know this woman, and so that by the time we get here, I don't feel like, oh, it's just another Dax he's in love with. He's actually in love with Ezri because he spent the time to really know this person.
Yeah, I never felt that it was about the fact that she was Dax. I always felt that it's the fact that it's Ezri. He just likes Ezri. It has nothing to do with her being Dax. In fact, the fact that she is Dax may be sort of an obstacle a little bit to the relationship.
Oh, definitely. And the other part of this storyline that I really liked was just the Worf and Miles watching from the sidelines, because it's their two best friends, you know, her best friend and his best friend.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was great. In fact, for most of the episode, Worf doesn't actually even say anything. He just presses a button and makes them go back down, and that's just
classic.
That
was the best part, was when they come up the turbo lift, or whatever the term is on the station there. It's not exactly, it's just more like a cargo elevator. But they,
yeah, it is kind of cargo.
But when they come up, and they're kissing, and Miles walks by, like, just, you know, people come up there all the time. Even earlier in the episode, we saw someone come up and walk out of there. And he's walking by, and he just kind of stops and does a slow double take, and then, all right, and go over to Worf. Looks like they worked it out. And then, like you say, Worf just press, you see his finger go down and it's press awesome. That button and they go back down. That was so awesome.
It is great. It's a great wrap up to that story. I mean, obviously it continues into the last episode, because, well, they're finally in bed together, but, this was a good resolution to them finally having the conversations and realizing that, well, we're both irresistible to each other. Why should we keep resisting? Resistance is futile.
You mentioned that they end up in bed together. I was just picturing there's another Holosuite program, but instead of Vix, it's Barry White.
Yeah. Oh, that would be awesome.
All right. Well, so that's Bashir and Nesri. I don't have a whole lot to say about what happens in this episode other than they finally come together and it's sort of awkward and they try to back away from it one last time by pretending like they can just let the feelings go and be friends, but clearly they can't, and so they finally come together. The next big character thing to talk about is Grand Nagus Quark, or Rom. It's fun because I never noticed this before, actually. Maybe I'm alone in this, but when Quark is talking to the Grand Nagus and there's all that static going on in the transmission, and I also was thinking, apparently they're using Skype. But Ferenginar and the station, they've got like a Skype connection going on.
Oh my gosh, it's terrible.
The quality of that call, it was pretty much like a Skype call, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But what I never noticed before is that at the very, very end of that, the very last thing that the Grand Nagus says, he says Rom. And you can tell he says Rom if you're watching for it, if you're listening for it, but it's in static. And maybe everyone else picked up on that the very first time they watched it. But for me, I'm more focused on Quark right at the end of that and not paying attention to how the Grand Nagus fades away. So if you notice that, then you know the whole time that Rom is going to become the Grand Nagus. But if you don't pick up on that, it's fun to watch Quark all the way through the rest of the episode thinking that he's going to become the Grand Nagus.
I think it works perfectly. I'm with you. I didn't notice that, Chris. I still didn't notice it rewatching it today. And I always think it's funny. You know, throughout this series, the redemption of the Ferengi has been happening. The change mm-hmm. in the Ferengi, you know, they've always been a great mirror for Western civilization and our materialistic, consumeristic natures. And I love how Quark, you see how far he's come and how pissed at himself that he is. You know, he's like, I didn't even haggle with you. And then he gives the whole speech. The line must be drawn here, this far, and no farther. It's just fantastic that he's quoting Picard at that point.
That was awesome that was in there. Yeah.
But, you know, his upsetness at being, you know, turned into, you know, kind of a softy when it comes to business is really funny. And, I mean, gosh, got to give it up to Jeffrey Combs, double time in it here is Brunt and Wayoon. Awesome.
Especially, and it has in the credits, Jeffrey Combs as Wayoon and Brunt. But not only that, but you cut from the scene of Brunt in Quark's kissing up to Quark. And then immediately you've got Wayoon on the big screen on the side of the building on Cardassia to go from Jeffrey Combs right to Jeffrey Combs. Was something, and I was actually, this time, I was watching Brunt really carefully to see how different Jeffrey Combs is portraying the two characters, and when I'm watching really, really carefully, it's a little bit more noticeable to me, the similarities between Brunt and Wayoon, but unless you're really watching for it, you don't notice, and I think he does an amazing job of playing these two completely different characters that you're going to see back to back.
It's like the Star Trek Double Mint commercial, W your pleasure, W your fun, Jeffrey Combs.
Gosh. Now I'm picturing Wayoon and Brunt riding a bicycle together.
In tandem, built for that would be awesome. I would love it. Oh,
along
man.
The beach, got the ocean in the background.
This is a brilliant commercial idea. I love it.
What would that be? It's Wayoon and Brunt's double mint gum.
Yeah, do they? Yeah, can we get that? You know, there's that whole episode where they're playing baseball, you know, and they've turned gum, you know, Bashir's asking O'Brien about this thing he's chewing on, and he's infused the gum with scotch. So what would be their flavors? It's like, you know, Sluggo Cola and
that would
two be, grubs or something.
Yeah. I'm picturing double your greedness, double your deceptiveness. Oh,
oh man, that's so funny. But yeah, this is a great, it is a great storyline to see, you know, Rom finally get his due. And mm-hmm. the fact that if you were to watch the series and you're watching specifically for the Ferengi episodes, you can see this kind of change happening. And you can kind of see Rom get smarter and smarter as the series goes on, so that when his mom's like, you know, you always just underestimated your brother, he's not really an idiot. He's kind of clumsy and he's not as cutthroat. And that's the big difference. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I think the first time I saw it, I felt it was a little bit out of the blue for Rom to become Grand Nagus. That's when you're watching the series for the first time and you're watching one episode per week. But if you go back and you watch the series straight through now, you can actually see that they gradually set up a situation where it made sense for Rom to become the Grand Nagus. And they do it in this episode as well. Not only the conversation between Quark and Rom, but even before that, but especially the conversation between Quark and Rom about how things have changed on Ferenginar, and also the explanations that Brunt gives to Quark about how things are on Ferenginar right now. You're not going to have as much power as you think you're going to have. It was all set up to show that the way that Rom views the world and the way that Rom views society is in line with his mother's views, which have now influenced Zek's policy. So it makes sense that they would choose him to be their successor. It makes no sense that they would choose Quark to be the Grand Nagus. And I have to think that Quark is just blinded by his own ego and his own greed to even think for a moment that they were going to make him the Grand Nagus. He's completely on the other side of the spectrum from everything that Zek and Mugi had been working on to change Ferengi and to evolve Ferengi society.
It is so funny because they set up Rom when he's haggling about the bar and Quark's complaining, and every answer that Rom has is the answer that the new Ferenginar would have
right.
to Quark. It's just
about.
Awesome. Yeah. And I do, though, I think it's really funny. I like it at the very end where Zek's like, maybe we picked the wrong brother. And and that you can tell that there's a part of Zek who still is very Ferengi.
Oh, sure.
Like that he hasn't completely bought it. But
definitely.
Yeah, of course, they're going to go to Ryza. So,
I do not. If I'm on Ryza, I don't want to see Zek in a swimsuit. I don't want to see him sitting around the pool.
I don't want to be anywhere near him in Ishka's room.
No.
Because I don't want to hear those squeals.
Don't put me above their room. Don't put me next door to their room.
You see those Ferengi over there? Can I have a room anywhere else but around them?
I'll even take the room next to the ice machine.
Yeah. To the Klingons. I don't care.
This is what's really funny, that, you know, a lot of fans think it's really strange that Rom would be made Grand Nagus, because on the surface it does seem like Quark would be the more ideal choice. A couple of things related to that. First of all, Ira said that there's no way that Quark could become Grand Nagus because he is the station. His bar is the center of station life. You have to have Quark on the station. You have to have him in the bar at the end of the series. He said they did talk about making Quark Grand Nagus, but they decided you just can't do that. You have to have him there. And this is the part that I thought was really funny too. So Max Gradenchik and Armin Shimmerman both also felt that Quark should not become Grand Nagus, because Armin said, of course, Quark has to be there. He's the station. And he also said that without setting it up properly, without planting those seeds, or as Renee Echevarria has described it, laying the pipe, to set you up for Rom becoming Grand Nagus. Without doing all that, it would seem like making Jake the head of the Federation.
Yep.
But I think they set it up really well, and they did it gradually over time.
No, I'm with you. I think it works, and the more you watch the series, the more it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I really like that turn.
So, next character moment here, we're going to kind of combine two things here. I want to talk about Damar a little bit, because we've been building him up as we talk about the final chapter. I think we praise Damar's transformation in almost every episode we do about the final chapter, and yet he almost gives up here. He almost throws in the towel, and it takes Kira and Mila on Cardassia to prevent him from falling down and help him find that inner strength to rise up. And I would say rise up and take charge, but he had already taken charge, but to rise up and find the strength to carry on and see things through to the end. And then that couples with the fact that the Dominion has taken the upper hand, but they've decided to fall back. So they decide to fall back. Damar decides to stay the course and to fight back and to fight them right at the heart of everything on Cardassia. So what do you think about these two elements of the war, the Dominion, the Cardassian resistance?
What I love about this is that the three of them are lying on cots in that basement, and they're talking about how stupid they think they are. How stupid they think they are.
There's a part that was cut out where they were actually going to get drunk while they talk about
this. Yeah, exactly. And actually, in some ways, I almost feel like they have been drinking, and they're just laying there, they're either drinking or kind of high, and they're just sitting there talking about how dumb they were to try and take on the Dominion, and feeling sorry for themselves. And it takes Mila coming in and talking about what's going on the outside, the fact that people have made Damar a legend, basically. He's not dead. My brother saw him and all of these things. And so,
well, he's the classic. Yeah, he's the classic figure like that, the leader that even if he were killed, people would create the stories that he wasn't, because they need someone to latch on to.
They need a hero. A hero in the end of the night. And he's gotta be soft, and he's gotta be tough, and he's gotta be fresh from the fight.
So Matthew, before we recorded the show,
Bonnie Tyler.
Maybe Bonnie Tyler should have played Mila in this
episode. Would have been awesome.
Just before we recorded this, we recorded a Literary Treks with Kevin Dillmore and Dayton Ward, and you resisted the urge to sing throughout that recording. I can see that you can't control yourself anymore.
Well, it's just so funny, because I was just thinking about that's really what happens. The people need a hero, and I love that Kira, and I kind of think that this is where Kira's kind of mythic spirituality really come into play here. It's I think it's subtle, but the idea that she can kind of think above just the mundane and realizes if we can build you into a mythic hero, you can't fight that. You can't fight a legend like Robin Hood or, those kind of things. And so that's what we need to turn you into. And I love that that's what happens, because it really does encapsulate who Damar has become, because he's become worthy of legend at this point. Just his character arc and everything that's happened to him in the last season and a half has created, I think, a character that is a legend. And this part of the story is brilliant to me. I really appreciate it. And the scary part of the Dominion saying, hey, let's just pull back in our borders. We'll build up a big ass army, and then we are going to come out swinging the biggest club you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Is scary, scary.
Thank goodness Sisko and Martok were there and the Romulans weren't in charge, because the Romulans would have been happy to let them fall back and just take the whole, let's just keep them self-contained, which is always a bad military tactic to say, let's just, you know, as long as they're over there, they can do anything they want, it's fine, and we'll just be over here and we'll be fine, when you know that on the other side of that, they're building up to hit you again. So, and the Klingons, of course, see right through that, because the Klingons aren't gonna sit back in that situation.
And well, and I, yeah, and I, what I love too is this strategery. I'm going to use that word, the strategery of,
okay,
of it's a Saturday Night Live reference with George W. Bush. Strategery. Anyway, that Ross and Sisko have, they understand clearly that this is not the time to sit back and that we can finish this. And it may be bloody to knock into their lines at this point. Yeah. But if we don't, it'll be even more bloody. And if we think, you know, millions of people have suffered already, billions of people are about to die.
Yeah.
But it'll be about 5 years from now.
And Ross, I mean, there's no way he was going to hold back, because if you're rocking a belt buckle like the one he has in this episode,
no,
you can't be timid.
I'll bet he's got a 10-gallon cowboy hat and some boots as well. I mean, whew, man. Actually, that's who W takes after. So
that would be funny if admirals not only got belt buckles but also got 10-gallon hats
and cowboy boots. Star Trek.
And cowboy boots,
yep,
with spurs on them.
Ooh, those nice ostrich ones, you know. And yeah. And anyway, yeah.
All right.
But no, I love the. I think it's great.
If we go back to Garrick, Damar, Kira, Mila, down in the basement of this house, there's one line in here that I love that almost feels ad-libbed, when Garrick says to Damar, "You never told me you have a secret mountain hideaway."
Yes.
Damar,
yes,
says, "I was going to surprise you."
That was perfect.
In fact, almost felt like an ad-libbed response, right?
It did. It did. It was awesome. I was watching the episode before we recorded, just finishing it up, and I think that might be my favorite line in the whole thing, just because it feels so perfect, because that's exactly the kind of thing you say at this point, you know? And coming from Garrick, "You didn't tell me you had a mountain hideout." And all I can think of is that stupid program of Bashir's.
Yeah, right. Well, see, for Garrick to say it felt natural that he would say it. That's something Garrick would say. But for Damar to just casually say, to have this witty comeback, "I was going to surprise you," that was not in character for Damar. And it felt right at the same time.
Yeah. Again, at this point, I think everything is running on all cylinders. And if you have read the background information in the companion, you know what a time crunch everybody was under, crazy everything was. They're all riding over each other, trying to make sure everything fits together. And somehow it just plays so beautifully. And I think the actors at this point are just in their element. These characters are their own, and they're able to do those things and to pull that. I mean, even if that's not an ad lib, the way that they perform it just as natural as can be. So, I mean, all around this episode, I think has just some of the best acting of the series, because it's so effortless.
Absolutely. Yeah. This episode was really hard to put together, because it sort of reminded me of when they were doing All Good Things and Generations and they were writing them at the same time. This is a little bit different situation, but they were breaking What You Leave Behind while they were doing this one. And the difference here is that if they come up with something for the finale that has to be set up, then they have to come back to this episode and make sure that that little bit of setup gets in here. So it's very difficult to put together this type of episode when it's leading you straight into another story and you're doing them simultaneously, but this one's got to go out first.
Well, and you know what's crazy to me is that it doesn't just feel like a filler episode. It feels like, okay, there are some things that we are going to wrap up here. We're going to wrap up the Ferengi stories. You know, some of those side characters, we're really going to put a bow on that. And they're, you know, they're not going to be the focus of the last episode. So,
right, because most of them aren't in the last episode. This was right. the last appearance for most, except for Quark.
So I really appreciate that. I think that this episode stands very well with the rest of the series, that I'm not watching it thinking, I don't really need this episode. No, this is paramount.
This episode is like The Empire Strikes Back turned up to 11, where it's a bridge story between what came before and what the resolution is going to be. So it's setting up all these parts of the story to be resolved, because unlike The Search for Spock, for example, where although The Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, and The Voyage Home make a great trilogy now, they weren't conceived of as a trilogy. Whereas with Star Wars, you have this story where this is where it starts and this is where it ends. And you've got this middle piece that's setting up the final chapter, the final portion of the story. And this episode is really doing that. Even though it's part 8 of 9, it's like the first 7 parts are one, and then there's the 9th part, and then you've got this bridge right here.
Yeah, it is very much a bridge. And yet, at the same time, watching it, I don't feel like that I'm on the bridge. I feel like I'm a part of the flow of the entire story.
Yeah.
And that's a great job. So
last thing to talk about here is the sort, it's not a coda really, because it's part of the episode, but the end of the episode when we find out that Cassidy is pregnant and Sisko, he's got so much weighing on him right now to walk in and find out that you're going to have a baby on top of all this. I mean, that is a load of bricks. And especially he knows that. He has a son, so he knows the whole experience of having a baby and raising a child and how much work that takes in the midst of everything else that's going on. And yet at the same time, I think it's really Cassidy who is more concerned about this situation than Sisko is.
Yeah, you know what I think is really funny too is that it's because he forgot to take his injection.
Well, they both forgot to take their shots, right?
And No, he did.
Yep, right?
It was just him. Yeah, he forgets to take his injection. So you know, it's great to see that in the 24th century. You know, keeping yourselves from having a baby is the job of both people, you know, it's not just one person. So it's some nice equality there. But yeah, the way that Avery Brooks plays this scene, I thought was brilliant, because it is that, are you sure? Like, you know, the first reaction I think of any guy, because, you know, we don't have as much to do with it afterwards, you know, it's like, we just get told, oh yeah, I'm pregnant. And we're
not
like
the ones who find
out.
Yeah,
exactly.
First.
We're not the ones who find out first, you know? So I really like that's what happens. Mm. And the way that he kind of just plays that. And then, of course, the loving way that he approaches her afterwards. No, of course I want this baby. You know, I'm so excited. And I love, too, her freak out, you know, that she is so worried about that something's going to happen to their child, because what if the prophets, that's what they were talking about. And the way that he just reassures her and loves her is really fantastic. All the way across here, I thought Avery was just, you could tell the man is not only a father, but a husband, by the way that he plays this scene.
Yeah, it is very natural, the way that you would expect a loving husband to react to his wife,
mm-hmm.
and someone who is a father and has had that experience before. So that really sets up things to come as well. So we're not going to talk in depth about that. The fact that there is a baby on the way, though, is just one more of the many, many things that they put into this episode to set up the incredible final chapter, the final episode of the final chapter, which we'll talk about next month as we conclude this long series. And I know, Matthew, we've been talking about what we're going to do for that episode, and I think it's probably going to turn out to be a bit of a bash, a big monster episode.
A monster mash.
Oh, I set you up for that.
yeah, you did. No, Chris, I don't know how we could do it any other way. I mean, you know, Deep Space Nine's What You Leave Behind, you know, nowadays it may be split up into two parts and like, you know, on your Netflix or whatever, but it is a 2-hour movie. It's the, you know, the hour and a half finale.
Mm-hmm. Which is the way we watched it when it first
exactly,
came on.
And it really does flow together. And so it needs to be talked about all together, as well as kind of seeing how all of the things from this arc all wrap together. But when you start talking about the end, we also have to think about, okay, so what about what they set up all the way through the series, you know, from Emissary on? How mm-hmm. does this wrap up the series? And I think of all the Star Trek series that were out there, this is the one where they were telling almost really a complete story. You know, you didn't leave Deep Space Nine thinking, I need more story. You just wanted more story. But if that's mm-hmm. all you ever got, it's a complete story of these people and the station and what's happened. Obviously, as a huge fan, I wanted more story, and then we got the relaunch book series and everything. But, you know, whereas, you know, you end TNG and they're still going off and doing the same thing. So you right. really literally missions. Could just come back yeah. next week and, you know, but this, everybody was going in different places.
Just and, like you've had before. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. That end is going to be, I'm going to be sad that we've reached it because I've had so much fun with this. But we've had some great ideas from the listeners from the mm-hmm. Babel conference, Chris, giving us some good ideas for some other series we can do. And, we're going to be considering, kind of adding that into our repertoire as well. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about here in the Orb. Just because we've reached the end doesn't mean that we've reached the end of the Orb.
Yeah, exactly, Matthew. I get questions from people reasonably often, fairly often, asking us when we say the final chapter, the end of the final chapter, is it the end of the Orb? People think we mean it's the final chapter of our show. That's not what we mean. It's not, the Orb isn't going anywhere. We have years and years worth of stuff to talk about here, but it's the end of the final chapter of Deep Space Nine itself as a series. So there you go. That's the Dogs of War, but that's not the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They look at the original series episodes, and they see thematically what it is that works, and they pick that in order to explore like a different side of it.
Earl Grey.
No, do you guys seriously no. not know why they have red and green lights?
No. Not all of us have read Ships of the Line.
Okay, no.
Wait, is this in Ships of the Line? I'm only in like chapter one.
No, I'm talking about like real ships today.
Have you been on a ship, Darren?
The Orb.
Them being adversarial, I don't think necessarily was the only way they could have gone. It makes for a great story, but it just made me wonder, just an impossible universe, what would have happened.
I think it's important, though, that she, as the religious leader, is not sold on the idea that this outsider is their emissary.
To the journey!
Endgame cannot make my list.
I don't have as much hatred for Endgame as you or apparently everybody else does.
Oh, not that I'm bitter or anything, no.
Warp 5.
So I would argue in the case of what Paxton is doing here in firing a weapon at San Francisco, which luckily missed and went into the bay, and I don't know if, I guess George and Gracie aren't there right in the 22nd century, so they're okay, but...
The Ready Room.
They could have really diverged with what we knew of Will and made Thomas's own unique character. I mean, he is, but like, if we can get multiple Burial episodes, why can't Thomas Riker have more than one episode?
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
And he happens to figure it all out. Yeah, that's enough to drive an audience.
We need to get Will Wheaton on the show because I will defend Wesley in this episode against the guy who played Wesley.
Okay.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
There was an interview, I think, with JJ where they were talking to him and he was saying that, you know, oh, my dad was friends with Nicholas Meyer back in the day. I remember going to Meyer's house when I was a kid.
And he had a whole bunch of really cool things in his house, and I thought, I would like to break some of these.
Literary Treks.
But I do like
I want to
cover.
See Spock with a perm.
Oh, gosh. Well,
I think I've got a Photoshop project in my future with this cover right here.
Melodic Treks.
It's like, oh, this wow. happened. Oh, this is so good. It was. No it was joke. Just
that
amazing.
Is how she reacts. And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. We're all over the place. If you're an Apple user and you would like to help us out here at The Orb, there's something that you can do that will make a big difference for us. And that is to go to the iTunes store, whether it's in the desktop iTunes application or in the podcasts app on iOS, and click subscribe. If you're not already subscribed, if you stream the show, if you listen to the show from some other source, if you subscribe in iTunes, it helps us rise up in the search rankings and it helps other Star Trek fans find the show. So that's a great way to throw a little bit of help our way here on The Orb. Another way you can help us out in iTunes is to leave a star rating and a written review. Those also make a difference in how we rank in search results. Plus, we love to hear from you and know what you think about the show. If you're not an Apple user, we are there for you everywhere else as well. We're in Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud. We are all over the place, BlackBerry as well, Windows Phone. You can go to our website and stream there. You can grab the RSS link and drop that into whatever tool you use to read podcast feeds. We try to get the show out to you in every way possible. You can even download audio files if you'd like. On the webpage, look at the SoundCloud player in the upper right corner. There's a little download icon. If you click that, you can download the audio file. Now, Matthew, you mentioned the Babel conference there at the end of our discussion. Some people may be thinking, wait a minute, this is DS9. It's not the original series. What are you talking about? So, Matthew, tell everyone what the Babel conference is.
Well, Chris, the Babel conference is our closed group there on Facebook. It's taking the place of our forums, and it's giving, I think, us and the listeners a great way to interact about Star Trek. It's been fantastic. I've had a great time on there already. There's so many different conversations going on, poll questions, all that kind of stuff. If you'd like to join, just go search for the Babel Conference, click to join. Chris will make sure that you get approved. Now, you do have to be approved for this. And the main reason is we just want this to be a great discussion. And we also want it to be a friendly discussion and a respectful discussion.
And we want
discussion.
It to be for our listeners as well.
Exactly.
Not just anyone who wanders in, who just happens to kind of casually like Star Trek.
Right. And so this is a great place. Go find us there on Facebook. Apply to be a member, and we'll get you your credentials there for the Babel conference, and we'll get you set up. And
so when you say apply, Matthew, this all this means is that you go there and you click the join button, and that's it. So if you go to Facebook and type the Babel conference into the search bar up at the top, that's B-A-B-E-L, or go to our website and click discussion on the top menu bar. Those will both take you over there, and then just click join group, and then that will notify me. I'll approve you as soon as I see the notification. If it takes me like 6 hours or something, it means it's the middle of the night here in Japan and I'm asleep. Otherwise,
it doesn't mean you're going through the screening process.
That's right. I'm in front of the computer almost all my waking hours and I always have it open. So I'll usually be really quick as long as I'm awake. So come join us over there. We'd love to hear from you. Aside from that, there are many other ways that you can get in touch with us. Of course, you can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose The Orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. And if you want to send us a voicemail, which we would love to hear from you by voice, you can go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM, or you can look in the left sidebar on the website on the show page, and you'll see the little tool for that there. A few other ways that you can help us out here at The Orb and help us keep the show coming to you include becoming a patron of the network. If you go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll see our page there. Patreon is a lot like Kickstarter, but instead of supporting a single project, it's a way for you to support the creatives that you love on a month-to-month basis. And on that page, you can set whatever amount you would like to contribute to us each month. We have listed all of our current goals. Some of them right now are one-time goals. Some of them are ongoing, so you can see what we need to do with the money that we get from contributors, from patrons. We also have milestone contribution levels listed and the perks that you get in exchange. We have a lot of great perks for you. Of course, we have things like digital wallpapers, but we also have things like associate producer credits, an opportunity to sit in on the recording of The Orb or your other favorite shows. We have lots of different things for you there. And in fact, we have had three people take advantage of associate producer credits here on The Orb. And those are Norman C. Lau, also Lisa Stevens, who you can find on Twitter at Flip18, F-L-I-P-1-8, Flip18. And also Ruth Ward, who you can find on Twitter at Reward64, R-E-W-A-R-D-64. So we really thank Norm, Lisa, and Ruth all for their great support of the show. They're helping us keep The Orb and Deep Space Nine Talk coming to you every week. And you can do that as well if you go to Patreon and check out the different contribution levels and the perks. Again, that's patreon.com, patreon.com/trekfm. One more thing you can do to help us out is to support our sponsor for today's show, audible.com, the best source for audiobooks that you're going to find anywhere. I love Audible. I listen to audiobooks from Audible every single day of the week as I'm working, as I'm preparing shows and doing things here on the network. And you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible if you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm. Just sign up for the trial, choose the book you want. If you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose. You'll get to keep that book. But when you support Audible, it really helps us keep The Orb coming to you every single week. So try them out, audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show as well. Now, Matthew, we've told everyone where to find us as the show, but what if people want to find you personally? Where can people find you when you're not down there in the cellar drinking a great bottle of Kanar with Damar, Garrick, and Kira?
Well, Chris, I do like my Kanar with Damar, but when I'm not doing that, you can always find me, of course, on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can check me out doing Literary Treks with you. We talk about books and comics, interview authors from the Star Trek literary universe there. So I hope you'll join us. It's a lot of fun. And then, of course, you can check out my own personal blog at 42lifebetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're trying not to get caught snogging in turbo lifts, where can we find you?
At least I know that if it happens, Worf will quickly return me to a private area.
He's a good man.
You can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/C. Brian Jones. And then I do a lot of shows on the network, of course, Literary Treks here with Matthew. Also, Warp 5, Continuing Mission, Matter Stream, The Ready Room, Hyper Channel. And I co-host the official podcast of Star Trek Axanar with Axanar creator and executive producer Alec Peters. So those are all the different places that you can go and find out what else I think about events in the world of Star Trek.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.